welcome back to another Throttle Up show. Now, last week we were out of the country, so we did a repeat. This is the new show this week. In fact, I just got back in the country. I was traveling to Israel, and I did a Holy Land tour with a group, and so it was really a fascinating time for me. And understanding, this is actually my first trip to Israel and that part of the world. It is, you know, we didn't really have a lot of service from the United States over there until fairly recently due to various reasons. Most of them were aircraft limitations. We have now aircraft that can fly farther, more efficiently. And so those areas have opened up quite a bit for travelers from the West, Westerners, from North America in particular. Now, the airplane I took over there originated from Newark and nonstop from Newark to Tel Aviv. So that was fairly new in terms of trip offerings, I suppose you could say. Anyway, so what I wanted to do this week is to discuss a little bit about my trip over to Israel, and from a Christian standpoint, it's also referred to as the Holy Land. And of course, I'm a Christian, and I was delighted to be there and to actually view these sites, these historical, and we consider them to be sacred sites up front and in the actual setting. And so that was a rather, well, it was enjoyable and enlightening as well, and kind of special for me and my wife and the group that I was with. Anyway, so I wanted to talk a little bit about that experience and share with you some ideas and I guess mostly it's some impressions that I had. Well, you know, because I guess you could say that it sort of like fits into the throttle up model, which is looking at the world from a bit of a different perspective, considering the big picture. You know, we did a 10-part series on big picture thinking, which I would highly recommend. You know, all these shows are in podcast format, of course. You can get them on iTunes as well as going directly to my website, throttleupradio.com. You can find these shows and you can download them in podcast format and take them anywhere, anytime. And I guess that's one of the reasons why we do fairly often, we do special editions, special shows, special events, because we're feeling that they have enduring qualities, and since the show is also available in podcast format, why not? Why not do it? And so that's where we're coming from here, and that's why I do it as well. So anyway, the big picture idea behind this whole trip, I wanted to cover it in some way, not belabor a lot of stuff, because I'm just kind of a broad brush, kind of a quick overview. I did want to share some thoughts about that particular trip and all the experiences and my impressions, and encourage others if you are so inclined and have the abilities to do such a thing. I would suggest it as a priority trip for most folks, particularly those that are in my age bracket that have some additional time to do it. Anyway, where should we start? Well, let's start. What I'm going to do is, I'm getting ahead of myself here. What I'm trying to say is that I'll talk at some length about this trip of mine to Israel, and then finish up with some comments, remarks, and I think I've got one or maybe two audio clips of President Trump's visit to India, which is also a very important event in human in world affairs, geopolitics. You can, you know, pull out a number of names from the hat. It was quite a remarkable event, in my view. It was extremely well received by the Indian people, as well as the Modi government. Prime Minister Modi is quite a remarkable fellow, and I would encourage all of us to, well, to learn and refresh ourselves on what is going on in India in terms of the socioeconomic conditions and in terms of national defense, in terms of their relationship with Pakistan and the Kashmir and other places. And so that's all part of this big picture idea that I would like to promote and to foster in terms of us getting a better handle on what's going on in the world. You know, I heard it kind of an interesting quote recently, and I don't remember where, I apologize for that. I don't remember where it came from, but I thought it was particularly good. This guy was talking about, well, we have two choices. We can sleepwalk through history, or we can make some sense out of it from a global perspective, or another way of saying that, it could be equally as good from a historical perspective, from recent history, from ancient history, from Middle Age history. So, you know, my idea here is if we are living a fruitful, meaningful life, we ought to think about those things too. We ought to think about how do we understand, or how should we understand, what's going on in the world? How do we make sense out of it? How do we relate it to ourselves and our families and to history? How do we relate it to the, you might say, human progress? How do we relate it to the human condition? How do we relate it to this particular country and its prosperity, the prosperity model that we employ? How do we do all of that stuff? How should we think about these things? And of course, that gets right back to this whole idea of critical thinking anyway. Critical thinking is also comes by the name of metacognition, which of course means that we are thinking about thinking, or I suppose a better way of saying that is that we are thinking about how we should think about something. How should we go about thinking about something? And that, you know, I find that pause there, that slight pause in our thinking trajectory, that slight pause where we ask ourselves or pose the question to ourselves, how should I think about this? Not what is going on, or what is this event, or what is that particular set of details or circumstances, but how should I think about, or how should we, or, and yeah, you know, we can make it personal. We could ask ourselves, how should I think about such and such, particularly if it is uncommon, if it's unusual, if it is challenging. I like to use the term mission critical if it is vital, or if it is mission critical, or if it is urgent, or if it is necessary, or whatever. In other words, it's not a trivial matter. It's a non-trivial occurrence. How should we go about thinking about it? How should I go about thinking about such a event, such a turn of events, such a situation, such a circumstance, what have you? Okay, so let me start with this trip to Israel. I will also refer to it as a trip to the Holy Land. It encompassed most of Israel, but not entirely, because there was a couple of sojourns into Jordan for historical purposes. So there was some rather interesting historical sites that we visited as well. Of course, Jerusalem is in itself a historical site, quite a remarkable place. The Old Town, or the Old Jerusalem, as well as the New, and the areas surrounding the Temple Mount, the Dome of the Rock, all of that stuff. We'll get into that in some, relatively briefly, but we'll do that today as well. Not that we will not be talking about it in the future. There may be other things that we want to discuss as well concerning that. I do think that there's probably going to be more discussions from me concerning Benjamin Netanyahu and what's going on politically in Israel. I suspect that there's going to be some additional things that that we'll want to talk about because of some situations or current events, whatever. Okay, so we flew into Tel Aviv. Now, we were there, when I say I'm talking about my wife and I were there for about 10 days. So we flew into Tel Aviv, nonstop from Newark, and it was a rather delightful trip. It was on a Boeing 777, so it was quite comfortable. And so we got there. I guess we got there in the morning, since we flew all night. Got there in the morning, somewhere around 9 o'clock in the morning. So Tel Aviv is on the coast. It's on the Mediterranean coast. It is a, our hotel was right on the beach. So it was, you could say that Tel Aviv is also a beach resort city. I would not disagree with that at all. I think the beach there is quite beautiful. I think the ocean, or the view of the Mediterranean, is quite spectacular. Of course, this was in February, this month, which is February, and when we got there, there was a period of time there that was particularly warm, and so there were a lot of people out and about. There was a lot of people enjoying the sunny, warm, sunny weather. There was people swimming and stuff like that. I think most of the people were in wetsuits. I would say wasn't quite warm enough for me to swim, being in February. Summertime would be better for most. Anyway, so it was a beautiful experience because of the area that we were in. It was really quite lovely. And of course, I love the beach. I love the ocean. Love the water. And there was a lot of water activities going on. There were windsurfing. There was regular surfing. There was little sailboats. There was all kinds of stuff. Paddleboards. You name it. Kayaking was big. And that's something that I enjoy doing quite a bit. And kayaking was really seemed to be quite popular there. So the experience is rather pleasant. And we met the group there, and we had some, you know, nice social gatherings and stuff like that. And then we started this tour, which is kind of like made a big giant circle. So Tel Aviv was a beach experience, and it was a nice way to start this adventure. And then we went up to went up north. When I say north, I'm talking about we go north along the Mediterranean coast up to Caesarea, and that is an old Roman ruins, I guess you could say. It was an old Roman city. It's no longer active. It's in a state of where you would consider it to be a Roman ruin. It was built during the Roman occupation as a coastal city. There's a couple of reasons why it is not currently, what you might say, not currently active. It's mostly in a state of, as an archaeological site. I guess that would be the best way to describe it. Anyway, so we toured the Roman ruins there, and it was a palace as well for King Herod, who was working under the Roman rule at the time, and it was a port city, and it was not a natural port, but it was constructed by the Romans to function as a demarcation port, as a port where trade could occur for the ships and boats plying the Mediterranean Sea. And it was a rather fascinating tour of the Roman ruins. They obviously did quite a remarkable job, and the whole thing was historically interesting, I would say considerably interesting in many respects. Anyway, so we went from there to a little town along the Sea of Galilee. Now, one of the things that, you know, that is not well, at least from my perspective, was not well understood, was once you move inland from the Mediterranean coast, what happens? Well, what happens is rather fascinating, because you have a long, narrow belt of fertile land that borders the Mediterranean, and the elevation rises. There's some low-lying mountains, if that makes any sense. They go up to about 2,000 or 3,000 feet, and then it drops abruptly into what is an extension of the East African Rift Zone. So the land drops considerably. Capernaum is, in fact, on the Sea of Galilee. Sea of Galilee is, in fact, not a sea, but an inland lake, freshwater lake. It's natural. It's natural, and it's huge. And part of the reason why it's huge is because it's in this depression, which is a block fault depression called the East African Rift Zone. It extends all the way up there from Africa, from East Africa, all the way up into that part of Israel and Jordan. And the water source for the Sea of Galilee is the Jordan River. And it comes out of the mountains further north, and those mountains rise up pretty high. They go up to somewhere, I think, around between 8,000 and 10,000 feet. I'm not exactly sure. I've heard both. My studies indicate that they go up to about 8,000 feet, so we'll stay with that. That's pretty high, and it collects a lot of snow in the winter. So anyway, that's the headwaters of the Jordan River. Then Jordan River flows directly south through the Sea of Galilee into the Dead Sea. Eventually, it stops at the Dead Sea. It doesn't have any outlet, and so it stops in the Dead Sea, and that's where it basically stays. It evaporates. Dead Sea is pretty large, but all the water there collects and it eventually evaporates. So anyway, Capernaum is a biblically significant city. I would say city. I would characterize it more as a town. I'm not sure what is the best way to say that. I would call it a town rather than a city, but I guess some people would consider it to be a small city. It's in a fertile area. It is it's fairly low, so it tends to be tropical, but it does get quite a bit of moisture. It is not desert. It's more of a tropical belt. It is warm in the winter. I suppose it's fairly hot in the summer. I would guess it's about Capernaum is about 800 feet below sea level, so it's fairly warm, but it's lush. There's a lot of moisture around, and of course you have the Sea of Galilee for as a major water source, which is a fairly large lake as inland lakes go. The circumference of it is 13 miles. I think it's 8 miles wide. So it's a fairly large body of water. Natural fish live there and is a food source because of the fish. All right. So that was fascinating. There was other aspects of it that if you would like to learn about it or visit, there's other aspects of it from a biblical perspective, which are also fascinating. Okay, from there we went to a city in Jordan. The city is called Jerash, and it has, of course, it still exists, but it has a Greco-Roman rune there that is really quite fascinating. It is considered to be the best preserved Greco-Roman rune in the area, if not anywhere, to be found. And so we toured that. We walked through this archaeological site. It was really quite fascinating. And you can get pictures of it easy enough online and stuff like that. But what struck me is two things. Number one is they were able to exploit the local water source, which happens to be, now I'm going to say a spring. It could be more than one spring. I'm not certain of that. I kind of think it was, but one spring was mentioned in the tour by the tour guide. And so the way that the original of the Greeks under the reign of Alexander the Great, as well as the later Roman occupation and expansion and refurbishment of the city, the way the water was exploited was really fascinating. They also had a sewer system. Now, I'm not making this up. They had a sewer system in place. They had a rather remarkable water distribution system, and the city was laid out in a very methodical and a really quite beautiful way. And even now, you can see how really spectacular this city was. I would call it the spectacular city of stone. It was all made of stone, naturally occurring stone that was used as construction material as well as beautification. The carvings, and it was just the amphitheater, which was amazing. Everything was just so fascinating. You're there and you sit a little bit and you contemplate how we could do such a thing or how these people could do such a thing, and what a remarkable achievement this was from a historical perspective, from a human perspective. What people are capable of doing if they have a vision and can organize themselves and can do purposeful work and live in a way that they are able to perform these kinds of activities, but which basically means there has to be an excess source of food and water. And that's what that means. And how they were able to do that through their agricultural systems and through their irrigation and water reclamation capabilities and harvesting the water and distributing the water is all fascinating to me. It's all a remarkable testament to human ingenuity and achievement. Okay, so from there, it's a short a drive down to the Dead Sea, and the Dead Sea is the lowest point in the world that is not covered by ocean, and it's we're going to say it's 1,500 feet below sea level. I believe that's probably correct. There was some. I think it probably varies. I think it varies between 1,300 and 1,500 feet below sea level. Nevertheless, we were there. Went to a rather pleasant and well-developed resort. It's the Dead Sea Marriott Resort. was really quite a remarkable place. I was very, very impressed. The first class operation, and it was right on the Dead Sea, and of course we all went swimming in the Dead Sea, and they talk about, well, you can float, you don't sink, and that's true, and all of that is true and fascinating. The whole experience is really pretty special. So I spent a couple of days there, and then we went on to Petra, and Petra is in Jordan. It's in the Jordanian desert region. It's very close. It's not on the Dead Sea. It's fairly close to the Dead Sea, but it's a little bit higher up in elevation because it's not exactly in the East African Rift depression. So it's a little bit higher up to the east. And we went there. Now, Petra is actually a very fascinating place. We're going to spend a little bit of time discussing Petra. And I've got a few things that I want to read to you because I think they're rather enlightening. Now, Petra is an archaeological site. Now, there is a village nearby, but Petra in and of itself is no longer occupied. It is strictly a archaeological site that is being excavated and being discovered, but no one lives there. It is a special place now. I don't think you could live there. I think it is some kind of a national park in the country of Jordan. Anyway, it is also on the list of the 7 modern wonders of the world. That was recently announced by some UN organization. I'm going to say UNESCO, but I'm not exactly sure that that's correct. Anyway, so there is the 7 wonders of the ancient world, and then there's the 7 wonders of the current world, or 7 wonders of the existing world. Is either ancient and current. We'll say those two terms. I'm not sure I'm using the right term there, but anyway, so the 7 wonders of the new world, I think that also was a term that I've heard. And Petra is one of them. So you can look that up. It's fairly easy. You can Google the 7 wonders of the modern world or the current world. You can do that. And Petra is one of them. And there's a really good reason for that, because it's a really remarkable place that you find. You come across this it's just so incongruous. You're coming, you're walking through the Jordanian desert, and all of a sudden you hit some mountains. These are sandstone mountains that go up somewhere in the vicinity of maybe 4,000 feet from the desert floor of about maybe 2,000 feet, I think, is the desert. And all of a sudden, you go through these mountain passes, and boom, you're there at this ancient ruin. And a lot of it is just remarkably preserved. It's really quite an amazing place. So I'm going to take a short break and set up this this report and read you a couple of passages from it, because it is a rather remarkable place. And by the way, Petra was home of a group of people that they're not very well known. In fact, I didn't know about them. They were called the Nabataeans. The Nabataeans, they're not sure where they came from. They think they came from Arabia somehow, but there was it was its own culture for sure. And they lived in this place called Petra in the surrounding area, and they built it. And what a remarkable achievement that was. It was a city of stone, of course. It was spectacular. Still is, by the way. When you go visit it, you're just in awe. It's in a sandstone canyon arrangement, and the sandstone is fairly colorful. Some of it is actually rose-colored. It's really quite remarkable. So you're in the sandstone canyon complex, if you will, and all of a sudden it opens up into some kind of a large amphitheater kind of arrangement, and there is this city. There is this ancient city. It goes back to about 130 BC. I believe that's about where it began, and it extended on into somewhere 600 or 700 AD. I'm not exactly sure the exact dates of it. So it was inhabited for a long time. And it was on the trade route. So it was actually a stopover point for the camel caravans that used to, there used to be a number of trade routes in that particular area. So from the east, the caravans would come by there, and it was a major stopover point for the caravans. And the place was quite wealthy, as well as blessed with some water sources that were quite unusual. And the way the Nabataeans harvested the water and distributed the water with remarkable water systems were nothing short of stunning. Anyway, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to read you some stuff from a book that was written about this place. Okay, I wanted to say a couple more things about Petra, and then we'll get on to Jericho and Jerusalem. Petra. Okay, this is in Jordan. It was the home of the Nabataeans. The Nabataeans managed, I'm reading this, this is book about Petra, The History of the Rose City. One of the new seven wonders of the world is the name of the book. The Nabataeans managed to create an oasis at Petra through their masterful control of annual flash floods with a system of dams, channels, and cisterns. The dry, mountainous terrain and spontaneous winter rains presented both challenges and opportunities for the Nabataeans. Some reliable natural springs existed in the surrounding area, and in addition, some areas had a sufficiently high water table so as to enable wells to be dug to collect the groundwater, such as those found in a couple of areas. This allowed them to farm the surrounding land that would otherwise be dry and barren. Though pastoralism likely continued along sedentary farming lifestyle areas. In addition to the mastery of water management, the Nabataeans were skilled stonemasons. The dominant Cambrian sandstone of Petra is of medium strength and with a uniform texture, which made it ideal for quarrying and dressing ashlar blocks, constructing freestanding buildings, and carving decorative facades. Now, one of the things about Petra is that there was a lot of sandstone cliff faces, and they did a lot of carving in the natural sandstone cliff face. Some of the facades leading into hollowed out areas were really quite spectacular, and I think that's probably why it made the list of the seven wonders of the world. The new seven wonders of the world is because of those rock face carvings or those cliff face carvings of buildings. One of them is called the Treasury. It's just really quite remarkable. Okay, so and then we went on from there to Jericho. Jericho is also very close. In fact, it's almost on the Dead Sea. It's just north of the Dead Sea, and it's also low. So it's in this East African Rift Valley. Jericho is, I think, 1,200 feet below sea level. It is the oldest continuously lived-in town in the world. It has been continuously occupied since, I think they said, since 8,000 BC. So it is, in fact, but it's in an area which is called an oasis. So there's a number of water sources there, and it was quite a remarkable place. And then on to Jerusalem. We spent quite a bit of time in Jerusalem going through a lot of the Christian sites that are considered to be important as well as sacred for Christianity. And we'll cover some of that in some future shows. Hopefully we can do that next week. Now I want to get on to the one more thing I want to talk about a little bit is Trump's visit to India. So we're going to be I'm going to play an audio clip of Trump's visit to India. And the reason why I want to do this is because I thought that really this was really quite a remarkable event in terms of current events, in terms of world affairs. The reception that Trump got in India was nothing short of astounding. Most observers have pointed out that never in modern times has a foreign dignitary received such a standing ovation in a particular country that he was visiting. Anyway, so his talk was really quite remarkable. I want to cover at least some of that before we finish up the show.
Namaste. Namaste. And hello to India. This is such a great honor. Let me begin by expressing my profound gratitude to an exceptional leader, a great champion of India, a man who works night and day for his country, and a man I am proud to call my true friend, Prime Minister Modi. The First Lady and I have just traveled 8,000 miles around the globe to deliver a message to every citizen across this nation. America loves India. America respects India. And America will always be faithful and loyal friends to the Indian people. 5 months ago, the United States welcomed your great Prime Minister at a giant football stadium in Texas. And today, India welcomes us at the world's largest cricket stadium right here in Ahmedabad. It is a profound honor to be the beautiful new stadium, to be here with you. Motera Stadium, so beautiful. And joined by so many distinguished guests from all across your nation and all across the world. To the hundreds of thousands of everyday citizens who come out and line the streets in a stunning display of Indian culture and kindness. And to the 125,000 people in this great stadium today, thank you for the spectacular welcome to your magnificent country. You have done a great honor to the American people. Melania, my family, we will always remember this remarkable hospitality. We will remember it forever. From this day on, India will always hold a very special place in our hearts. The life of Prime Minister Modi underscores the limitless promise of this great nation. He started out by his father's side as a chihuahua, a tea seller. When he was a young man, he worked at a cafeteria in this city. Stand up. Everybody loves him, but I will tell you this, he's very tough. Today, Prime Minister Modi is the tremendously successful leader of this vast Indian Republic. Last year, more than 600 million people went to the polls and gave him a landslide victory like no other in the largest democratic election ever held anywhere on the face of the earth. Prime Minister Modi, you are not just the pride of Gujarat. You are living proof that with hard work and devotion, Indians can accomplish anything, anything at all, anything they want. The Prime Minister has a moving story of an incredible rise And so does this entire nation. Your nation is doing so well. We are very, very proud of India. The story of the Indian nation is a tale of astounding progress, a miracle of democracy, extraordinary diversity, and above all, a strong and noble people. India gives hope to all of humanity. In just 70 years, India has become an economic giant, the largest democracy ever to exist, and one of the most amazing nations anywhere in the world. Since the turn of the century, India's economy has grown more than 6 times in size. In a single decade, India has lifted over 270 million people out of poverty. Under Prime Minister Modi, for the first time in history, every village in India now has access to electricity. 320 million people, more Indians, are right now connected to the internet. The pace of highway construction has more than doubled. Over 70 million more households, think of this, 70 million more households have access to cooking fuel. 600 million more people have access to basic sanitation. And incredibly, 12 Indian citizens are lifted out of extreme poverty every single minute of every single day. India will soon be the home of the biggest middle class anywhere in the world, and within less than 10 years, extreme poverty in your country is projected to completely disappear. The potential for India is absolutely incredible. India's rise as a prosperous and independent nation is an example to every nation all over the world and one of the most outstanding achievements of our century. It is all the more inspiring because you have done it as a democratic country. You have done it as a peaceful country. You have done it as a tolerant country. And you have done it as a great free country. There is all the difference in the world between a nation that seeks power through coercion, intimidation, and aggression, and a nation that rises by setting its people free and unleashing them to chase their dreams. And that is India. This is why India's accomplishment over the last 70 years is completely unrivaled no matter where you go. It is your faith in the strength of a free society, your confidence in your own people, your trust in your own citizens, and your respect for the dignity of every person that makes the United States and India such a natural, beautiful, enduring friendship. While our nations have many differences, they are both defined and propelled by a fundamental truth, the truth that all of us are blessed with divine light and every person is endowed with a sacred soul. As the great religious teacher Swami Vivekananda once said, the moment I stand in reverence before every human being and see God in him, that moment I am free. In America and in India, we know that we are all born for a higher purpose, to reach toward our fullest potential, to work toward excellence and perfection, and to give all glory to God. Powered by this spirit, Indians and Americans are always striving to be greater. Our people are always seeking to be better. And so our nations have become thriving centers of culture and commerce and civilization giving light and vitality to all of the world. This is the country that produces nearly 2,000 movies a year from the hub of genius and creativity known as Bollywood. All over the planet, people take great joy in scenes of Bhangra, music, dance, romance, and drama, and classic Indian films like DDLJ and Chhod. This is the country where your people cheer on some of the world's greatest cricket players, from Sachin Tendulkar to Virat Kohli. Greatest in the world. This is the country that built the tallest statue on the face of the earth to honor the namesake of this stadium, the great Indian patriot and native of this state, Sardar Patel. India is the country where hundreds of millions of light candles to celebrate the triumph of good over evil at Diwali. It's where, just days from now, Indians of all faiths will pour out onto the streets to celebrate the beautiful festival of Holi. India is a country that proudly embraces freedom, liberty, individual rights, the rule of law, and the dignity of every human being. Your nation has always been admired around the earth as the place where millions upon millions of Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs and Jains, Buddhists, Christians, and Jews worship side by side in harmony. Where you speak more than 100 languages and come from more than 24 states, yet you have always stood strong as one great Indian nation. Your unity is an inspiration to the world. In America, we have come to know the splendor of Indian culture personally through the 4 million Indian Americans living in the United States as our wonderful friends, colleagues, and neighbors. They are truly spectacular people. Indian Americans enrich every aspect of our national life. They are titans of business, the biggest, the best, pioneers of science, masters of the art, and innovation of technology like few people have been able to see, no matter where you go, anywhere in this universe. Nearly 1 in 4 Indian Americans trace their roots right here in Gujarat. Gujarat is a special place. So on behalf of the entire American people, thank you, and thank you all for the contributions your culture and traditions have made to my beloved country. Americans are eager to strengthen these beautiful ties between our two people. This is truly an exciting time in the United States. Our economy is booming like never before. Our people are prospering and spirits are soaring. There is tremendous love, tremendous like. We like and we love everybody. Unemployment has hit historic lows and small business confidence has hit an all-time record high in the history of our country. Our military has been completely rebuilt. It is now stronger than ever before, and we are quickly revitalizing our alliances and friendships all around the world. We have spent $2.5 trillion on rebuilding our military. It's the most powerful military anywhere in the world by far. That is why I have come here to India in the spirit of fondness and goodwill, to expand our cherished partnership of incredible power and potential. The First Lady and I have just had a pleasure of visiting Mahatma Gandhi's ashram a few miles from here, where he launched the famous Salt March. And tomorrow in Delhi, we will lay a wreath, plant a tree at Rajghat in honor of this leader who is revered all around the world. And the First Lady and I look forward to visiting one of your country's most iconic landmarks. We are later today going to see the majestic Taj Mahal. The Prime Minister and I will also continue our important discussions about how to deepen the relationship between our two great countries. Both of us understand that when leaders put the interests of their own citizens first, we can forge strong and fair partnerships to build a safer and more prosperous world. Just months ago, this critical partnership took a major step forward when the U.S. military and your brave Indian Armed Forces conducted the first ever air, land, and sea military exercises between our two countries. It was something to behold. We called it Tiger Triumph. As we continue to build our defense cooperation, the United States looks forward to providing India with some of the best and most feared military equipment on the planet. We make the greatest weapons ever made: airplanes, missiles, rockets, ships. We make the best, and we're dealing now with India. But this includes advanced air defense systems and armed and unarmed aerial vehicles. And I am pleased to announce that tomorrow our representatives will sign deals to sell over $3 billion in the absolute finest state-of-the-art military helicopters and other equipment to the Indian Armed Forces. I believe that the United States should be India's premier defense partner, and that's the way it's working out. Together, we will defend our sovereignty, security, and protect a free and open Indo-Pacific region for our children and for many, many generations to come. The United States and India are also firmly united in our ironclad resolve to defend our citizens from the threat of radical Islamic terrorism. Both of our countries have been hurt by the pain and turmoil of terrorism and that terrorism brings. Under my administration, we unleashed the full power of the American military on bloodthirsty killers of ISIS in Iraq and in Syria. Today, the ISIS territorial caliphate has been 100% destroyed. And the monster known as al-Baghdadi, the founder and leader of ISIS, is dead. In the United States, we have also made clear that while our country will always welcome newcomers who share our values and love our people, our borders will always be closed to terrorists and terrorism and to any form of extremism. That is why we have taken historic steps to improve screening and vetting of applications for entry, and we are working to ensure that anyone who threatens the security of our citizens is denied admission and will pay a very, very big, costly price. Every nation has the right to secure and controlled borders. The United States and India are committed to working together to stop terrorists and to fight their ideology. For this reason, since taking office, my administration is working in a very positive way with Pakistan to crack down on the terrorist organizations and militants that operate on the Pakistani border. Our relationship with Pakistan is a very good one. Thanks to these efforts, we are beginning to see signs of big progress with Pakistan, and we are hopeful for reduced tensions, greater stability, and the future of harmony for all of the nations of South Asia. India has an important leadership role to play in shaping a better future as you take on greater responsibility for solving problems and promoting peace throughout this incredible region. Over the course of my visit, Prime Minister Modi and I will also discuss our efforts to expand the economic ties between our two countries.
Okay, remarkable speech, and we will see you all next week.